This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We have some thoughts this hour on Pope Francis, to be particular, on U.S. responsibility for the refugee crisis in Europe. Some first-time local candidates tell us why they decided to take the plunge and run for office. Also, a haunting story of a war still snuffing out lives far from the battlefield. But we begin this hour thinking hard about prison in America. There are more than 2.2 million people serving sentences behind bars in America, many more in jail awaiting trial. Millions of ex-felons with criminal records who find that once released, their access to social services, health care, legal information, and counseling all vanishes. That's right. In-prison programs offer more support for these millions of Americans than the outside world does in rebuilding their lives. And there's been a broad and urgent realization that none of this is working, that our whole system of sentencing and incarceration that was born in the tough-on-crime political era of the 80s and 90s needs to be reformed. How did we get here? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. How could something that was second nature in politics a few decades ago, being tough on crime, be replaced by a new movement for, in some cases, radical change?
It's a really interesting dynamic, John. And to get part of the answer, we have to go back to how we got here, back to the 80s. You mentioned it. The war on drugs, societal fear of violent crime, and politicians' quest to be tough on crime.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times.
Now, John, that's the infamous Willie Horton ad from the 88 presidential campaign. It's what made Michael Dukakis, who was the former governor of Massachusetts and had sponsored a furlough program that let Willie Horton out of jail and committed that crime, it's what made Michael Dukakis soft on crime. Now, that attack actually came not just from Republicans like future President George H.W. Bush, but also from Democrats like Al Gore in the primary. America was terrified of violent crime, terrified of drugs, and our politics reflected it front to back. Flash forward here to 1994.
Let us roll up our sleeves to roll back this awful tide of violence and reduce crime in our country. We have the tools now. Let us get about the business of using them.
You recognize that voice, President Bill Clinton there in 1994, signing the 94 crime bill. That crime bill, John, is now blamed even by Bill Clinton himself as being one of the factors that helped fill the prisons with offenders, many of them nonviolent offenders, and got us into the mess that we're in today. The 94 crime bill had tougher sentences for drugs, lots of nonviolent offenders, also the three strikes policy, three felonies, life sentence. Many experts and analysts blame three strikes now for putting millions and millions of people in prison who probably don't need to be there or are having a hard time getting rehabilitated. But not just the 94 crime bill. Lots of other factors, too, seem to have contributed to this problem. Deinstitutionalization of mental hospitals in the Reagan administration back in the 80s. It was an important step after a Supreme Court order. The Supreme Court said you have to treat mentally ill people in the least restrictive means possible. And that meant that lots and lots of mental hospitals were emptied of patients. That was a good thing. Many of those patients never got appropriate treatment after they were released, and their new warehouse, John, became the prisons instead of the mental hospitals, a big factor. Also, lots of people point to privatization of prisons and perverse incentives that may have created for states to cut costs while transferring money to corporations and getting more money the more prisoners that got into jail. But John, there's a call now to say, as you said, none of this has worked. And I'm going to play you an interesting voice here. Listen to Senator John Cornyn. He's a conservative, self-described law and order conservative Republican from Texas. He's also a former AG from Texas, a prosecutor, and a former Texas Supreme Court judge.
Well, there's no question about it. The pendulum has definitely swung. The irony is that that being tough on crime, locking people up in prison, does work, because when people are in prison, they don't have the time or the freedom to commit other acts of crime. What it leaves out of the equation, though, is the fact that most people will exit the prison at some point. And we have an interest in civil society in trying to encourage them to productive lives and not a life of crime.
Is Senator Cornyn going to be a leader on this reform movement?
Oh, there's no question about it. He has a powerful position on the Judiciary Committee, as I said, former prosecutor, former judge. He's got a lot of clout on this issue. He's one of many, and it's really running the political gamut here, from libertarians and conservatives to civil libertarians and liberals. Everyone seems to be on board. Now, there's no consensus yet on exactly what's going to get in to a criminal justice reform package. The players here keep saying we're close to introducing a bill, we're close, and they're not quite there yet because there's still some disagreements over what's going to be in a package that tries to move to the floor here. But we do know some of the parts. One, fewer incarcerations for nonviolent drug crimes. Not violent drug offenders, not traffickers, but the estimated hundreds of thousands of people who may still be in prison or jail for nonviolent drug offenses, particularly users, John. They want to make a change to that policy. They want to reform bail rules to prevent poor people who are accused of crimes from being de facto in prison because they can't afford to pay bail. That's a sense of imprisonment because of poverty, because you can't pay your bond or your bail. There's also a move to have more diversion to mental health treatment instead of incarceration. Sentencing reform is going to be a big deal. Some of it is controversial. There are moves to have good behavior policies and rehabilitation program policies within prison that can cut your time, lessen your sentence. Cornyn's on board with that, but Cornyn's not on board with reducing mandatory minimums. There's disagreement about this, and it's still controversial. Mandatory minimums for lots of different crimes, some of them nonviolent, that takes away, they say, judges' discretion on how long people should spend in jail. And that has resulted, some advocates say, in long sentences where judges and prosecutors don't have the discretion to give people lighter sentences if they merit it. And then, of course, post-release policies. How are you treated, John? How do you rebuild your life after you come out of prison? That's a big area that needs reform.
And what's the perspective of ex-cons who look at this reform movement and see something that might have something positive for them?
Well, this is just one facet of reform, but it's a really big deal with a lot of people. How the past and the law can conspire against ex-felons' future even after they've paid their debt and done their time.
This kept me from getting a lot of positions because in my field, they're going to do a background check.
Joshua Pruitt is 32. He moved to Washington, D.C. to pursue a career and to try to get beyond his criminal background.
Me right now, I'm just this mess up with old charges that need to pursue a change and find someone that can believe in me and help me change and wipe my background and clear it up.
Like so many Americans, that 7-year-old felony got Josh fired off of a job and has kept him out of the workforce ever since.
I obtained a job in my field one time in the state of Alabama running VLANs, basically installing the internet in these state parks. But once that company found out that I had background charges, they immediately terminated my employment. In 2012. I haven't worked for anyone, even subcontract, in 2012.
According to the National Employment Law Project, an estimated 70 million Americans, that's one quarter of U.S. adults, have an arrest history that can show up on a background check, even if they were never convicted of a crime.
I believe I still have that issue with my criminal background, because when I fill out applications, I put that check mark.
Saul Green is 60 years old. He's unemployed and living in a shelter on Massachusetts Avenue here in Washington, D.C. Saul doesn't use crack cocaine anymore, but his conviction and prison time for possession has kept him out of the workforce. Every time he applies for a job, it's a box he has to check that keeps him back.
Do you have a criminal background? And yes, I do. Then I elaborate, which I didn't elaborate the last time. You know, I just checked the box, but didn't elaborate. So now I'm elaborating. Therefore, that since they look at my criminal background, they say, well, we won't take a chance on him and move on.
A national campaign started all the way back in 2004 urges employers to ban the box and remove the "have you ever been convicted of a crime" question from employment applications. The point here is to give each candidate a fair shot at employment once the employer determines that they're qualified. Now, Saul says that's a start, but the other problem is what an employer can do after they hire you.
Not just the box, it's also the background check.
That's David Treadwell. He's executive director of the Central Union Mission here in Washington, D.C. That's where both Saul and Joshua live.
They're working on a thing to protest, ban the box. But you got to also, it's in the background check. So it's not as simple as just banning the box. is being willing to recognize when a person has cleaned himself up and give him a chance. We need employers to work with us, to open the door and give people a chance.
Treadwell says that despite Saul's recovery and his work ethic and tenacity, there's only so much the organization can do for him.
He worked with us. He was on time. He follows instructions. He's a good employee. We can depend on him. All those things that you need on your record, and it hasn't helped. We even bought him a cell phone so that he could take the interviews, and we still haven't found him a job.
And it hasn't helped. Why? What do you think's going on?
The felony. The felony is on his record.
I mean, we have a crisis of monumental proportion.
New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker is just one of many lawmakers on Capitol Hill looking at all aspects of criminal justice reform. He says there's a moral component here that requires an overhaul of the system to address the problems of mass arrest and mass incarceration.
In the course of human history, there hasn't been this kind of extreme where a nation has imprisoned this many of its own people. And even you're talking about imprisonment, there's also American jails, which have 19 times the admissions in prisons do, and even arrests. We're now at the point in our culture where we're arresting, you know, about 75 to 100 million Americans have been arrested, which is crazy that you would have almost one-third of the people in your nation being arrested. So we have a crisis in mass incarceration, hyper-arresting, and this problem is not going to be solved with one tool.
How convicted felons' history follows them after they get out of jail is just one narrow piece of broader criminal justice reform, but it's a part that people like Joshua and Saul say is key for them to rebuild their lives after paying their debt to society.
Todd Zulick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on the extraordinary levels of incarceration in the United States compared with places around the world and the political momentum behind the reform. Tomorrow, we'll look at what's happening on Capitol Hill, why despite an ugly partisan dysfunctional atmosphere, lawmakers from every corner of the political map are suddenly ready to work together to try for real reform.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.